Welcome back to Mindshift, the podcast that helps you to think critically about things like God, the church, and spirituality. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you from a shockingly rare sunny day here on the Rock in North Wales, where we live in the United Kingdom, one of the best places in the world to live, despite the terrible weather that we get oftentimes. Hey, we're going to be happy for a sunny day, and we're going to move on. I hope you've enjoyed the recent couple of episodes that I brought to you. There's been a wide range of topics. Last week, I did one on Jonathan Edwards and the Puritans and looked at some of the toxic theology. And then the week before, I brought you my sister Valerie, and she told her story of also being raised in a home that was guided by toxic theology, which, of course, they wouldn't have called it that at the time. To them, it was the gospel truth, following the teachings of people like Bill Gothard and others. And if you missed that episode, you definitely want to go back and catch that one with my sister Valerie, talking about giving up her baby for adoption when she was just 18 years old and the legacy of growing up in a fundamentalist home. And we talk a little bit about some of our experiences that we both had from the different perspectives of being 9 years apart. She's 9 years older than me. And then, of course, before that, we had a couple episodes with Dr. Hector Avalos, and we talked about his book, The Bad Jesus, The Ethics of New Testament Ethics. And even though I didn't really intend it to be this way, I guess there's one thing that does tie all these different topics and threads together, and that's this word that I keep mentioning, toxic theology. And it really affects people. It affects people's mental health. In fact, even going back further, when I talked to Mark Allen Shelsky and Steve Austin, we talked about how it affects people's emotional and spiritual maturity. Growing up in church and growing up around toxic teaching can really mess a person up. It even messed up Jonathan Edwards back in the 18th century. And so why should we think anything different today? So along that line, I'm bringing you an episode today which also, in a way, ties into this whole topic of toxic theology and how it affects people, more specifically in this episode, in churches. I'm bringing you a discussion that I had a few weeks ago with a friend of mine, Sean Manley. He and his wife, Cheryl, were staying here with us on the Rock for a week or so. And just before they left to go on a marathon trip, pretty much driving all the way across Europe, I was able to sit down with Sean and have a really good discussion. Now, this is an interesting thing because, as I say, the aim of this podcast is to help you think critically. Now, what you'll discover in this episode is that Sean and I, at first, we don't come from the same point of view. He's still in the system. He's still very much a part of the church in the States where they live. And yet he comes out of being a church planter, a pastor in Southern California down in Palm Springs. And it's a fascinating story of how that whole thing went down and how it affected him and his wife, Cheryl. But yet, he's elected not to leave the system. He's still very much a part of the church. But yet, as we discuss it and as we talk about his story and my story, when I was a pastor and the leader of a church in the Portland, Oregon area, we begin to discover that we actually have a lot more things in common than it might appear at first glance. And this is exactly the point of doing this podcast, and that is talking to people from a very wide range of views, points of views that you might not be exposed to normally. And it's not just about progressive Christianity or finding people who are totally deconstructing their faith. Some people like Sean are still within the system. And what I want to know is, can we sit down and have a reasonable and respectful dialogue and actually find out where we agree and talk about perhaps where we disagree and why that might be? One of the things that a recent guest, Mark Allen Shelsky, said, something that really still resonates with me, is this idea that the church in America is no longer capable of having any sort of nuanced discussion about doctrines, religion, theology, the Bible. We can't sit down and have a reasonable, respectful discussion about areas of disagreement or even agreement without having it descend into a shouting match, a slanging match. And I don't want to do that. I want to show you, I want to model for you, perhaps in these two episodes that I'm calling Measuring the Metrics for Success, how you can do just that. And so that's why I'm excited to bring you part one in this episode with Sean Manley, what I'm calling Measuring the Metrics for Success, because that seems to be something that we keep coming back to. What do you actually use as a standard, as a measuring stick for success, in air quotes, whatever that may be in your personal life, in your business life, your work life, or if you're a Christian, you're part of a church, or even a church leader, What's your yardstick for measuring success? Is it the numbers of people that you have at your church? As they say here in the United Kingdom, the number of bums on seats, or as they say in America, butts in the pews, how much money your church makes in terms of budget, how many staff you have, whatever the metrics of success. And this is something that Sean and I come back to again and again in this part one, as well as in part two, maybe a little bit more in part two. Okay, so before we get into the first half of this discussion with Sean Manley, I'll just say real briefly at the beginning of this episode that I'll talk some more about how you can contact me on social media at the end of the show. And I'll also mention how you can support the work of Mindshift on Patreon, become a part of our exclusive Facebook group, the Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, and join the other people in there who have agreed to help support me and become a part of the community. All right, so without further ado, let's get on into the first half of the discussion with Sean Manley, Measuring the Metrics for Success, Part 1, here on Mindshift. I am delighted to be bringing you a guest today. We've had a lot of people coming and staying with us in the last few weeks. And Sean Manley, do you want to say hi to everybody?
Hey, everybody. Great to be with you, Clint.
Sean and his wife, Cheryl, they've been staying with us about a week. Have you been here?
Yeah, one whole week in Wales.
And I've been kind of sort of toying around this idea of doing a podcast. We talked about doing one with Sean and Cheryl, but then we decided, okay, Sean and I are going to sit down and do a podcast because you guys fly out tomorrow.
We do.
Where are you going tomorrow? You're doing like the whirlwind tour of Europe, aren't you?
Yeah, we've got a little over 2 weeks. So we started out in Iceland. We were there 2 days, bounced over here. We've been cruising all over Wales, which is just absolutely gorgeous. I can see why you want to live here.
Yeah. Why don't we ever go back to America.
It's made me second guess, but I'm committed to my family in the U.S. So, you know, we got to stay there. But man, it is gorgeous here.
I did hear your wife asking today, or were you asking her, if you could buy a house here, would you live here?
Yeah, Bo Didris Estate.
It's just up the road. What do they want for it?
$2 million. $1.5 million, yeah.
Okay, so.
Chump change.
Just chump change. Just pull it out of the back pocket.
Right. Can I borrow that? Would you vouch for me?
Let's go in halves. So, yeah, I'll live in the back half. You guys, there's plenty of room up there. It's an ancient medieval hall that you can see out of our back door. So yeah, Bo Didris Hall is for sale. Right. So we'll hook that up.
Yeah, the castles you've got here, I mean, just incredible. Amazing. The countryside, the food, the pubs, everything. We're having a great time. So after this, you asked where we're going. Tomorrow we're bouncing to Dublin. We're there for one night.
One night in Dublin.
Nope. The next day we head over to Basel, Switzerland. We're going to bounce from there into the Black Forest. We'll be there for about a day, maybe two. And then we're going to take a long drive through the French countryside. Going to drive from Freiburg all the way into Bordeaux, stay the night there, and then another long drive. We're going to end up in Portugal, probably Porto and Guarda. So we're there for a couple days, and then we drive back through Spain and up to Catalonia, where they're having a little bit of problem right now.
You're a bit worried about that now, aren't you?
We are. Spain gave the Catalonians have 2 days to reject their own vote to secede. So
and that's right about the time you arrive, I think, isn't it?
It is, exactly, yeah. So we're a little concerned about our flight out, but hopefully on the 26th, we'll be heading back to the States.
Yeah, now where do you live in the States, by the way? We didn't get that out there. Where are you from?
South of Seattle.
South of Seattle.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is one of the reasons why we love living here in Europe is, as you say, you can be on the continent from Great Britain here within about 2 hours. Actually, Dublin is only about a 45 minute flight. So you can be in Ireland in less than an hour. From there, you can go almost anywhere, as you say. And now that it's a United States of Europe in a way, you can just literally drive from country to country country. There's no borders. You just see a sign, welcome to Germany, welcome to Belgium, welcome to France. And no more passports, no more 20,000 different currencies. You know, it's a great system in that way.
It's relatively inexpensive. Like, we're not going to drop just a ton of change to be able to do each leg of the trip. So, other than Iceland. Iceland's a little pricey, but everything else is reasonable. Yeah.
Would you go back to Iceland? You picked up a cold there, so you can kind of hear
I did. Yeah, the morning we're flying out. It's in my chest right now. But would I go back? I would go back. There's so much beauty to see in the landscape.
It is stunning.
But you got to budget for it. Yeah. I mean, it's tough to get by for about less than $300 to $400 per day.
That is insane. You were saying like you went to Subway.
Yeah.
How much was like just two meals at Subway for a Subway sandwich?
$25-$30.
$25-$30 when you can get a sub sandwich for like $3.
Pretty much. They got $5 footlongs some days.
Yeah, they've got 5-pound footlongs with a drink as well here in this country. So yeah, if you go to Iceland, it is beautiful, but wow, that's incredibly expensive, man. Well, one of the things we've been talking about as we've been, I didn't know Sean at all, actually, before this week. Now, our wives actually went to high school together.
They did, almost 30 years ago.
That's the connection. Neither one of us were married to them at that time. We need to point that out.
No, that would have been really awkward because I would have been in junior high.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So definitely not.
She's a bit older than you, but I'm a bit older than Lisa, but I was friends with her brother, so that's how we met through... We were in heavy metal bands. We played soccer together.
Nice.
So we were rockers and all that back in the day, back in the 80s, wearing the spandex and the leather and the bandana around the legs.
Oh, you were a hair rocker.
Oh, yeah. Right. I was a metalhead, total
pre-grunge.
Rocker. Yep, pre-grunge. The whole grunge scene came along in Seattle and just blew metal apart overnight. I mean, we played in bands for 10 years in Seattle. Yep. And it all exploded, and that was the end of the heavy metal scene. So I moved down to Portland, went off to Bible college and packed pretty much all that in. But so that put me on a different path. But we've been talking about Sean and Cheryl. They were ministers. You guys were the head pastor.
Yeah.
In a church in Palm Springs, California. Now, how is it that you end up in Palm Springs? What are you doing there? What was your experience? Can you give us the sort of story there?
Sure.
What happened?
Yeah, you know, I'll step back to when I was about 18 years old, and I'll never forget there was a woman in our church that told me she had a prophetic word for me, which was that I was going to be a pastor. And at the time, I laughed so hard because the idea of standing behind a pulpit, preaching, being the guy that's there, you know, week after week after week, like that's the worst form of torture for me.
Yeah.
I am bouncing around, juggling different things. I love to be out in the community. I love to work with people. I love to get stuff done. So for me on Sunday mornings, thinking that as being the climax of my week did not appeal to me at all. And so from that point, I had kind of a varied career path. I spent most of my time working in construction and then in retail. And then somewhere about the age of 29, this is kind of where I started heading towards that direction. At 29 years old, the Lord was really kind of just working on my heart, trying to get me to do something else that I didn't want to do, which was go into ministry. I actually have a nonprofit administration degree. I just thought I'd never use it.
Right.
And so I'm cruising along, going to make my career. I'm going to make a lot of money. And then maybe at like 55, retire and go spend the rest of my life doing ministry and volunteering or whatever else. But 29, I knew there was a shift coming that I was trying to prepare for. And I took me a year, but I prayed the prayer of Jonah. I don't know if you've ever prayed that prayer. You know, Lord, don't send me.
from within the whale, I think. Yeah, whatever he was. Yeah.
This was like pre-whale Jonah. This is when you're on the pre-whale. Ship saying, no, I'm not going that direction.
I'm heading the opposite direction.
I am, yeah. And I did for a year, and it was miserable. It was the worst year working of my life. And I'd started working when I was 12 years old, and I loved to work. We're made to work. And so I loved to be able to contribute. I loved to accomplish. But that was a bad year. A lot of interpersonal conflicts. I couldn't even talk to Cheryl about my work when I came home. I just was not in a good place. And so I finally severed my job. I had a great career, left. And then I made this transition to work in ministry at my kids' private elementary school. Not unlike the school that you and Lisa attended.
Right. It's like a small Christian school sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, 1,500 students. So I don't know if that qualifies as small, but you know.
Our school, we had 300.
Okay.
9 through 12. So that's pretty big, actually, for a Christian school in the Northwest, I guess.
Yeah. So I was there for 5 years, and somewhere around year five, the Lord, kind of in a similar way, but this time with Cheryl and I, started opening our eyes to see the possibility of planting a church. And it wasn't really anything that I'd ever been interested in. I certainly didn't study for it. I didn't go like you went to Bible school. I'd taken some Bible classes, and I was passionate about the church and mostly parachurch. Like I spent a lot of time around volunteering and working in the community around parachurch. But we just knew. We spent a lot of time praying, discerning, and really feeling like this was the next evolution of our working lives and for our families. And so it was hard, but we made the decision to move. That was in 2010. Gave my work 10 months notice. So
10 months. I thought you just needed 2 week notice.
Yeah, we had a lot of things going on at the school at the time. And so I was trying to leave honorably and on a great note, and it worked out really well. I mean, I feel like I left in a really positive place. And then we parachuted in. We went from, south of Seattle down to, as you said, Palm Springs. We're actually in a city called La Quinta, right in the center of the Coachella Valley. And we planted, at first it was a satellite campus. So we were a part of another church. There was a sending church from our area that sent us down. And that lasted all of about 6 months. And then we had to regroup. And then we planted as an independent church under the denomination. So that was our journey.
Wow. So that's a big transition, isn't it? You go from, were you teaching at the school? What were you doing?
I was an administrator.
Right.
Yeah, so you're in administration. I was reported to the superintendent.
Right. So you go from that. It's a major career change. Now you're suddenly the head pastor of a church plant in Southern California. I mean, it's a totally different context. There's a lot of money down there. It's totally different than the Northwest, isn't it? The weather's hot. Love Palm Springs in the wintertime. Summertime, not so much. How hot does it get down there in the summer?
Oh, man. It'll melt your face off.
Yeah, it's insane.
The hottest I ever saw was 129 degrees.
That is insane. You could literally fry eggs on the sidewalk.
Bake cookies on your dash.
If you wanted to, yeah. I don't know why anyone would want to other than to prove the point.
But you don't want to turn the oven on.
That's true, yeah. It's just that much more heat, isn't it, that you're putting in. So you planting this church, why would you want to plant a church? And of all places, Palm Springs. There are mega churches down there. I've been to some. There's some big-time churches down there of, thousands and thousands of people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money in there. It's an extremely wealthy area. Why Palm Springs, of all places?
Yeah, and this will let you know the greatest part of our whole journey was the team that we were part of. So as we started to explore our journey down, there started to be these other families that got brought into our lives that were the most incredible people we'd ever met. My best friend, I mean, some of the people that we were closest to and still are closest to were part of our leadership team. And so, we snapped a salute. We felt like this was the Lord leading us to do this thing. And we just completely took a step of faith, had no idea what it was going to look like. But by being down there, we had some of the greatest ministry experiences I've ever had and made the best relationships that I can even, people that I absolutely love today.
Right. So you're still in a relationship with some, but yet it wasn't all peaches and cream. It sounds like.
Definitely not.
What ended up happening? How long were you there in total?
And just the disclaimers, no church is peaches and cream.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so
there's no perfect total, church.
Yeah, we were exactly 3 years. We drove down September 1st, 2010. We drove out September 1st, 2013.
And was it planned to go on the same day?
No, it wasn't at all.
I'm giving you 3 years exactly, and that's
our departure was much quicker and not anticipated. And we wrestled. We did not know we were supposed to come back. Like, we had that kind of clarion call to go down. Our move back to the Northwest was, it was a lot of strife, struggle, angst financially. And part of that plays into this, Clint, is that I was not only pastoring, I was also the founder of a nonprofit organization at the same time. So what really led for us to come back up, the church was doing great. The nonprofit struggled. And that led to Cheryl and I needed to make some financial decisions that we didn't have answers for. And I was really in a place of brokenness. And so we just came to the point where I had a job offer in the Northwest. I needed to make money. And so we packed up everything we had left and moved back to the Northwest.
So your time in Palm Springs, would you characterize it then? Was it a great time overall in terms of your ministry at the church? You said you had some great relationships. Mm-hmm. A lot of amazing things happen. Now, we know Cheryl didn't want to be a part of this podcast. There was a bit of a discussion there.
Yeah, there was.
Because she felt like she had a completely sort of different perspective, during the time that you were at this church. What was going on with you and Cheryl? How was she doing?
Yeah, and I'll answer that. I'll tell you, though, just for clarity, so anybody who's listening knows that my wife, it isn't that she wouldn't want to contribute to a podcast.
Yeah, she was really torn, I think.
She was. And she wonderful. I love my wife. We've been married. We just celebrated a 22-year anniversary. That's part of the reason why we're on this trip is that, our anniversary was like 4 days ago.
That's true. Funny enough, we went to a pub and then you guys bought dinner for everybody.
Yeah, and for so anniversary. Like,
wait a minute, this is your anniversary, but you're buying dinner for all six.
That sounds like a great way to celebrate.
So that wasn't how it was supposed to happen. We were supposed to buy dinner for you guys, and they ended up buying dinner for everybody there. So. Yeah.
So Cheryl's perspective is still, I think, a little bit more entrenched in some bitterness and pain. But the bigger issue for her is that she doesn't meter her words very well. And so as a pastor's wife, especially, that always caused some consternation. Like, she was always struggling with that point of, like, how do I say exactly the right thing? Because I'm living in the fishbowl now. Everybody's watching everything I do and listening to every word I say. And if I don't say exactly the right thing, and I'm going to screw it up. And so that was part of the reason why she just said, you know what? Why don't you and Clint just have a good time?
Hey, well, that's it. We were talking about this thing about expectations. And this is one of the things that I learned when I was a pastor, when I was in church ministry for about 12 years, that there's two sets of expectations going on in, certainly in church ministry, but the church, the congregation is projecting a set of expectations on you, the leader. And they expect you to do whatever it is they expect. Everyone's a bit different. Mm-hmm. And the leaders are also projecting expectations onto the people. They're hoping that they'll, you know, give money or show up for church events or help out around the building or whatever those expectations are. And if those expectations aren't met on either side, oftentimes there can be trouble. And you see, I think a lot of conflict that ends up where pastors either quit or they get fired or it ends badly, or when these sort of unrealistic or unmet or unspoken expectations perhaps aren't met. And so you're saying, here's Cheryl, she's feeling like, okay, I'm in the fishbowl. Is this a good place for me to be?
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like she was very happy there.
So, you know, when you're measuring expectations, everything comes down to your definitions of success. Like, how do you define what you're trying to accomplish? And for me and our leadership team, when you're the founding pastor, you get to set all of your own success metrics. You get to define what that looks like. Really practical example. So all pastors have some awareness of what size church and how much money comes in. Nickels and noses, butts and buckets, however you want to measure it. You've got, you know, some level of awareness of what size you are and how much money you're managing. But that's not our ultimate measure of success, right? Every pastor would agree with that. Like, you know, how much money you have and how many people are going, don't tell you how successful you are.
Yeah. But there are realities. You got bills to pay, salaries to meet, overheads.
Yeah. Everybody's somewhere on that spectrum measuring that, but everybody's measuring it to some degree.
Yeah.
We were committed to measuring things that were less tangible, more qualifiable. So one of our measurements of success is, how long do people stay after a Sunday morning service? Is there a community that's happening after you've, you know, said a benediction. There's a prayer that happens and everybody gets up and goes wherever.
Stampede for the exit.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, because I used to live next to a church where you could set your watch by what time the parking lot cleared on a Sunday morning. It was
minutes after the last chord on the organ.
The parking lot was empty. Not a single car, not a single straggler.
The game starts at 1 o'clock and, you know, if the preacher goes too far with his sermon, you're in trouble.
You're watching it.
Yeah. That's one of the expectations, though. It can be.
So we set our own expectations. And what I mean by having such an incredible leadership team is they all bought into the same expectations. And so there was very little strife within that core leadership team. When we're talking about our department heads and we have a church council, there were about 12 to 15 people at any given time within that leadership team. And there was almost no discord. Like, it was really good. We had a great team. Now, what led us a little sideways was I was not communicating the same sort of expectations in the way that my wife needed to hear them. So that she and I were not on the same page. So it's like, I've got one team going really well, but this team at home,
not so good.
Team Manly was not on the same page.
Not doing so well. Now, what do you do in that situation? Because I can imagine there's somebody out there listening perhaps to this podcast, a vicar, a pastor, a leader in a church in some capacity who's hearing what you're saying, Sean, and saying, yeah, that's exactly where I'm at. You know, the ministry on whatever levels of success, as you say, as you define it, might be going well, but at home, if there's discord, if there's, you know, dissension, whatever, between you and your partner, what do you do? Do you choose one over the other? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people will, they'll sacrifice their families, you know, for ministry. For God, as they say, and yet their home lives are an absolute train wreck. But things are going great on a Sunday, seemingly. But in the end, they could lose everything. You know, that almost happened to you. Is that what happened?
You know, I would say we were never in a place where we were going to go down the tubes.
Right. Didn't get that bad.
Cheryl might challenge me on that, but she's not here to stick up for herself. So
that's true. She had her chance to be here.
we didn't ever get to the point where one of us was walking out the door. Neither one of us packed our bags, but there was definitely tension. And so what brought it to head for me was not the marital strife. It was the financial crisis. So my finances at home were not good because I had lost the job that I needed to be able to pay the bills. And so that little mini crisis created the cause for my marriage to then get healthy again. Now, so what would have happened if the finances weren't in struggle? What if we were making money? We could sustain the dysfunction.
Exactly. What if you stay at the church?
Yeah.
And what do you do?
So then I go back to, well, how do I measure success as a person? So me, one of the greatest measurements of success that I can have, I mean, in Matthew 25, we know that we want to stand before the Lord and hear, well done, my good and faithful servant. I'm responsible for stewarding my family first. It's a holy responsibility for me to tend to my children and to my wife. And if my faith drives them away from their opportunity to stand before the Lord, then I've failed. And that's the number one. Like, there's nothing that's more important than that. It doesn't matter how many people are going to your church or serving in your church or doing what, like, Christ already died for the church. I don't think I have to die physically, you know, unless I'm martyred somewhere. That's a different thing. But if I'm just killing myself, if it's a self-inflicted gunshot wound because I'm not tending to my family, then shame on me. Yeah. And so that's what I was faced with, is I had to get my family healthy. And I had to make money. So I came back and worked like a big dog. I mean, I did make money, but it was also that I needed to spend a lot of time tending my wife. But my kids, I think, grew through it too. I saw a lot of maturity in both my kids. My daughter's actively in the ministry now. She's going to the mission field. And, you know, you see some pastor's kids that are just jaded and bitter.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was really attentive to my kids to make sure they didn't get to that place where they hated the church because of what it cost. So yeah, if I'd been financially incentivized to live in dysfunction for a while, that would have been a tougher place to be.
Yeah. So it kind of, in a sense, now you're looking back on it, that kind of forced your hand in
totally.
A way.
Yeah.
But in
I
the
didn't
end,
have an option.
Was it the best thing now, looking back on it from the perspective of years later, for your marriage, for your family, what's more important, that things are going great at this church in Palm Springs, or that your marriage is really starting to get on the rocks? You know, you had to fix that. Well, you didn't have to. It ended up kind of being thrown in there and you had to deal with it, didn't you? From a financial
point
of view.
Well, I really wanted to deal with it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I wanted to provide. I wanted to be able to have a family that, you know, and our support network is in the Northwest. You know, we've been kicked so many times. I mean, I had a great leadership team, but man, some of the sheep bit hard.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I had a couple of really, really big stinkers. Frankly, I hope some of them hear this because they need to know they're big stinkers. And
yeah.
So, you know, why did they take such a big chunk out? I don't know. But
yeah. Do you have any stories that you want to share on this?
Man,
you told me one the other day, but I don't know if you want to share that about the family that came around and.
Yeah.
Had
you know,
a few words for you.
Well, yeah, we had a family that really did a number on Cheryl. I think they thought they were actually helping. And that's the worst is, you know, when they actually have deceived themselves so much that they think whatever they're doing is going to help. But they're just, look, if you see a train wreck of relationships everywhere they go, there's a pattern there.
Yeah. No matter where you go, there you are.
And I kind of sniffed that out.
Here.
Yeah, I kind of sniffed it out. I knew there were some little yellow flags and some things that I was aware of. And now, granted, I wasn't in a church as a 20-year-old as a pastor. I got into the ministry as a late 30-something.
Yeah,
so there's quite a little more awareness. And I think if I'd been in my 20s and put my family in a situation where my wife was now the target of somebody's maliciousness, I don't know how I would have handled that. And I feel like I did handle this situation well. Like, we escaped, right? Like, we lived to tell the story.
You got out of there.
But that one situation in which we were reported to the district, we were gossiped about throughout the community. Any church member that this family thought they could sway, they went after. And they represented a large chunk of our church. Like, they had, you know, probably a pool of about 18 people that were part of our church. But you know what happened after they left? Everybody breathed a sigh of relief. And I mean, the church continued to grow in relationship and depth. So yeah. It was a good thing. It really spun my wife out.
It's amazing when you study the life of churches and the dynamics that goes on. A lot of times there's this sense of, there's either one controlling person or, as you say, a family perhaps, and they have power in that church for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's financial reasons, money, they give the most money, or they've been there the longest, or a combination of some of those things. And some of these people or families can be incredibly toxic and damaging. Yeah. And we had a guy at our church when I was the pastor. He'd been in his claim to fame was that he had been there because the church had been planted about 18 years before I even showed up. And he'd been there. He was part of the original church planting team.
Like a badge of honor.
Yep. He'd been there literally from day one, because he was part of the church, the home church that planted the church. So he came out of that. So he'd been around forever. And he'd been to Bible college. So he had a degree. And he'd even been an elder at one point during his career. But he wasn't anymore. And this guy caused nothing but problems. Mm-hmm. Every time we had a woman preach, we would get a 6-to-8-page letter from this guy detailing all of his biblical reasons why it was wrong and why we shouldn't have women preaching and women in authority every single time. It was clockwork. You could just count on a letter from this guy. He criticized every decision we made. He was always a problem. And I remember we had a big meeting one time at one of our elders' houses, and it was about him. We had him in there. And I said to him, I said, "Why are you here? Seriously, I'm not being funny. Why are you here? You have caused me and all the other elders so much heartache and so much hassle and so many problems over the years. You've been nothing but a thorn in our flesh." And his response was, God's made me an overseer of this church. And I said, "What are you talking about, man? There is no such thing. You don't have a position. You don't have an office. You don't have any authority. Where did you get this idea?" Mm-hmm. And so he had this sense of, I've got to watch over this church. And every time I see anything wrong, I've got to, say something, do something, let everybody know. And it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. These kind of people, what are they doing there? Seriously. Yeah.
Well, the best advice I was given when we were first planning, this was actually after the satellite disintegrated, because, the church leadership team maintained, we just never got any traction. We were a part of this other church that was 1,200 miles away. And I actually went through, I had 3 different supervisors in 4 months of being there. And there was so much confusion. There's a whole backstory that I won't go into, but it was never going to work. And so we just basically restarted. And as soon as we did, we started to get, traction. But, this family that had come in really wanted a position of leadership. And I had the best advice given to me by anybody when I was planning. This is it. I asked a professor of New Testament theology at King's University. And he told me, Dr. Daniel Gilbert, he said, "Beware of the bitter people."
Yep.
And I thought, okay. And at 38 years old, I still didn't fully know who the bitter people were.
Now you know?
I do. Yeah, I think I can sniff it out a little better.
You found a few.
And, one of the ways that I discovered that they were bitter was that they were ready to leak their pain. And pastors want to pastor people by shepherding them along in their pain and hopefully leading them to a healthy place. But, some people just want to leak their pain all over the place.
Yeah, that's true.
I heard bitterness described once as dousing yourself in gasoline, lighting yourself on fire, and hoping the other person dies of smoke inhalation.
Man,
that described this family. Like, they just wanted to go around just dumping gas on themselves, or petrol, as you would say in the UK.
Petrol? Yeah, it's true. And this is something I talked about with my friend Mark Allen Shelsky. He wrote that book, The Wisdom of Your Heart. We did a podcast on this, and it's all about, he says, his famous quote in there, he's actually quoting from somebody else, that you cannot be spiritually mature and at the same time be emotionally immature.
Right.
And I've really latched onto that. I think that's absolutely the truth.
That's good.
There's a lot of people that are masquerading as spiritually mature in churches, but actually they're very emotionally immature. And there's a whole a whole list of reasons for why that is. But that sort of fits the description of these bitter people you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Very emotionally immature. But yet, a lot of people, because they know the Bible, they know the content, they know theology, they've been to Bible college, like this guy, he had at one point been in leadership. Mm-hmm. this guy should have never been an elder. An elder, no way. Right. In my estimation now, looking at it, but yet we'll put people like that in positions of leadership because they have a tremendous amount of knowledge, theology, Bible, whatever. But they're very toxic. They're very bitter people. Right. Emotionally,
well, you mentioned
immature.
Some of the ways that people will kind of win you towards them if they have money or if they have, you know, resources or something. You know, with this particular family, it's because they were first in, last out. Like, they were the people who set up chairs every time we needed chairs set up, and they were always willing to do something extra after you closed down.
Go the extra mile.
Yeah. And it was all with an intention. They wanted control. Really comes down to ownership. Like, they wanted to own this thing, and they wanted it just like the guy that you had. He was the overseer. Why? That's a control issue.
Oh, it's a control thing. I remember another friend of mine who we were pastors at the same time in Portland, and he had a church about 3.5 miles from where our church was. And we used to meet every Thursday. We'd have breakfast and kind of prop each other up, basically, because we were both struggling in our ministries. And he had this one woman who ran the church. Hmm. And he found this out as he'd been there, over the course of a couple of years, that if she didn't like whatever suggestion was being put out, it was going to fail, because it was a Baptist church. It was a congregational vote. So every decision had to be made by 100% consensus. And if she didn't like it, and she'd been there from day one kind of thing, and if she didn't like it, it was going to fail. And if she approved of it, it would pass. And wow. So to get the vote through, you had to make sure she was placated. And what ended up doing it in for him was that he fought her for 3.5 years to try to, make changes and implement things around the church. And she finally got to the point where she decided he needed to go. And that was the end of him.
He lost his job.
Yeah. So he sort of got ran out / quit about the same time. It was going to be mm-hmm. clear that he was going to be fired. And he said, I quit before they could fire
Crazy.
Him. But it's just insane. And it makes me step back and say, see, this is why I walked away from pastoral ministry. You've said a couple times that would you ever be a pastor again? And I said, no, someone would have to sneak up behind me and hit me on the head with a brick and drag me in to a church. Stranger things have happened. I'm careful every time I hear footsteps coming up from behind. Well, everybody, thanks for joining me on this episode, part one with Sean Manley, Measuring the Metrics for Success. Every time I hear that story about my friend who was the pastor of that church in Portland, as well as listening to my own story of when I was an elder and a pastor not far from where my friend had his church, and these toxic people, it's unbelievable why anyone would want to be in church ministry. Why would anyone want to be a part of this? And yet, as we discover, Sean himself, although he comes out of a very damaging and toxic experience down in Palm Springs in California, he himself has not removed himself from the system, from the church. He still believes in it. He's still very much a part of it. And even though, I guess deep down inside, I say I still believe in the church, in air quotes, I have to qualify what that means. Because to tell you the truth, I'm having a hard time seeing that the church is in fact doing anything to live up to the simple message, let's say, of Jesus, or what the early church maybe looked like in the book of Acts. Something that took care of the poor, took care of the homeless and the needy and the sick. Because what they formed there in the early chapters of Acts, anyway, as I read it, was an absolutely unbelievable community that didn't discriminate against the poor, the sick, the lame, the blind. Didn't matter what level or strata or society that you came from, you were welcome. And they took care of your needs as best they could, whether it was a financial need or a physical need or some other need. They didn't care. They helped you, and it was compelling. People came. And in the first few centuries of the church, we find and we read in church history that they couldn't say anything bad about Christians, as much as they were maligned and persecuted. But all that, of course, changed when Constantine made Christianity the state religion of Rome in the 4th century AD. And everything since then, I argue, has changed, and not necessarily for the better, when the church crawled in bed with the state. And in so many ways, what you've had since then is a hierarchical system, whether or not, like in America, the church is actually part of the state, or here in Great Britain, where the Church of England, for example, is still the official state church of England. And so it's hard to support a system like that. and this is where I struggle. But obviously, Sean, even though he has had reservations, even though he's had some bad experiences, as I say, he's not given up on the church, but he's very much involved in his community. And so I think it has changed him in many ways. So we're going to get more into that next week in part two of Measuring the Metrics for Success. All right, I just want to say before I let you go, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I talked about how you can get a hold of me on social media. You can follow me on Twitter, at Preachers Forum. You can also check me out on Instagram, at the same name, at Preachers Forum. And I talked a little bit about this last week. Instagram's a good way to get to know me a little bit more in terms of places I travel. I love history. I love to travel. And a lot of the pictures I post up on Instagram are from places that we like to visit, whether it's in Europe or here in Great Britain. So take a look at Instagram if you want to kind of get to know where I'm coming from or where I'm going or where I've been. I'd also love to hear your feedback on this show or any other show. You can send me an email, preachersforum@gmail.com, and I will certainly respond to you. You can also stop by and like my Facebook page, facebook.com/thepreachersforum. You can also check out some of the articles that I write on my website, preachersforum.com. You can go to the top of the page and see the Preachers Forum blog, and there's a lot of the articles that I've written on this subject of leaving the church to find God or leaving the church to find myself, articles about theoclasm, whatever that means, with myself and Gary Hayes. So take a look at the Preachers Forum blog. And then finally, I'll just say one last thing. If you found the work of Mind Shift helpful to you at all, challenging, thought-provoking, if it's helped you to think critically about anything, really, not just God, the church, or spirituality, you can consider supporting my work here on Mind Shift for as little as just $1 a month. What can you possibly buy for a dollar? You can barely buy anything good at the Dollar Tree or the Poundland if you live here in Great Britain. But for just $1 a month, you can help me pay for things like podcast hosting, website hosting, travel expenses, and other things that help me keep this podcast going. You can go to patreon.com/preachersforum and find out a little bit more information. And also, if you support the work of MindShift, you will be added to our official Facebook group, the MindShift Podcast Group, and join the community of others who have supported the work of MindShift on Patreon. All right, I'm going to let you go now. Thank you once again for joining myself and Sean Manley and listening in to our conversation. I hope that you found it an interesting and thought-provoking chat that we had. If that's the case, then be sure and join myself and Sean next week as we get into more on this topic of measuring the metrics for success. So I'm Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you once again for joining me right here on Mind Shift. Yesterday.